This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Senator Chris Murphy just got back from Europe talking to allies about U.S. spying abroad and counterterrorism efforts. He's also been outspoken about the role of the media in covering the Obamacare rollout. Then there's the Senate nuclear option, which allows for majority votes on judicial nominees and other appointments. Matter of fact, there's so much to talk about that Senator Murphy is good enough to join us in the wheelhouse today. It's our weekly news roundtable. As always, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, is here. We're joined by the cameras of CTN today, and we welcome in Senator Chris Murphy. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And if you want to join our conversation with questions for the Senator, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at Where We Live. You can send us an email, wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can find this all on our website, which is wnpr.org. Let's talk about this trip to Europe. You went to Berlin and Brussels. What were you doing over there?
I am the chairman of the Foreign Relations Subcommittee on European Affairs, and obviously the Snowden allegations have been a blockbuster here in the United States, but also in Europe, because a lot of Europeans found out that their own government, in coordination with the U.S. government, were doing mass surveillance. And we also found out that the United States has been engaged in some good old-fashioned political espionage, unfortunately listening in on some of our most trusted allies, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, at the top of the list. And so Europeans are angry about this, but there are potential real consequences to the United States. Their anger has led the European Parliament to recommend that Europe withdraw from a terrorist financing tracking program that is really important to global security. And there are a lot of people who want to cut off trade negotiations over a new free trade agreement between the United States and Europe. That agreement is really important to Connecticut because we do about 40% of our international trade with Europe. So we stand to benefit from some of the non-tariff barriers being taken down. So because this matters to Connecticut and because of, you know, my specific position, I went over there for about 3 days last week to just make folks over there know that the Congress is considering changes to our surveillance legislation, and to let them know that that there are also some bilateral agreements that we can enter into with European nations to try to set a new stage for how we do surveillance. It's not a debate unfamiliar to Americans, and wanted to let them know that.
Well, obviously, I guess if I was in one of these European countries, if I was a leader of a European country, and I found out that my leader, a longtime ally of the U.S., was being spied upon, I probably would think about pulling out of trade negotiations myself. I would probably think about not wanting to fund counterterrorism efforts myself. I guess the first thing to ask before we get into some of the details of this is, what do you, as a United States senator, know about NSA spying abroad or domestically? I mean, what do you know on a day-to-day basis about what information they're actually collecting, and what don't you know?
I don't know enough. We have an oversight system in Washington in which about 15 senators who sit on the Intelligence Committee get regular briefings on surveillance activities in the United States and abroad. And what we're learning is that the scope of surveillance is absolutely stunning. I mean, there is essentially, I think, an ethic over at the NSA that if you can do it, you should do it. And so we're listening in on way more stuff than we need to. We're getting the talking points of the UN General Secretary when he walks into meetings with U.S. officials, despite the fact that the advantage that it actually gives us is minimal compared to the embarrassment that comes to the United States when these revelations become public. And so right now, we don't know enough. And what's important is, A, that members of Congress get more information about what's happening, and the cost-benefit analysis changes, that we actually make an assumption that at some point our surveillance is going to become public. I mean, there's going to be another Bradley Manning, another Edward Snowden. And so you have to look out into the future and decide whether the information that you're getting is worth the embarrassment and cost to the United States reputation when somebody finds out about that. And that clearly has not been what's going on.
Do you feel that you at least know what Edward Snowden knew and released to Glenn Greenwald and the other journalists? In other words, do you feel at least as though, because not everything has come out so far. So do you feel, I mean, it would put you in a pretty terrible position to be going over to Europe and saying some of the things that you're saying to reassure them, and then have another round of disclosures that are already sitting in the pipeline. We're not talking about another Bradley Manning or another Edward Snowden. We're just talking about the stuff that hasn't played all the way out yet. Do you feel like you know what all that stuff is?
No. And frankly, I don't think the White House knows either. I mean, that's one of the things, for instance, that the Germans want to know. They say, listen, give us a packet that tells us what the future revelations are going to be. And at this point, the U.S. government isn't even able to do that because we don't have a handle on what he has. And that's the second part of this, right? I mean, I think Americans at some level are willing to accept that there's a new deal after September 11th, and they're willing to accept a different level of surveillance. But if a guy like Edward Snowden can just take off with the information and use it in any way, shape, or form that he wants, then people aren't willing to accept that deal. And so, you know, that's the danger here. We don't know what he has, and we're not sure that there's a way to prevent somebody else from walking away with that kind of information.
But it's not just Edward Snowden walking away with this information. It's the sense that you as a United States senator, or even the president of the United States, the people we elect to oversee how we're going to deal with the rest of the world, how we will be protected from terrorism, that these folks don't even know what the NSA is doing. And it's not so much what gets leaked out. It's that seemingly there's no oversight. So I guess I'll ask you, from a legislative standpoint, what can the Congress do? What can the president do to rein in NSA spying?
Well, one of the things we can do, for instance, is end the collection of what is called metadata, right? So we collect an enormous amount of information regarding who you're calling or who you're sending an email to. And then if we're suspicious about you, then we can drill down and get the content. There is a piece of legislation before the Congress right now that would end the ability of the NSA to do that. That's a substantial change that we can make that would greatly rein in the power of the intelligence agencies. Now, I don't think, frankly, the answer is for, you know, 535 senators and representatives to have daily briefings on the exact nature of our both domestic and foreign surveillance programs. A lot of this stuff does have to remain classified, and 535 members of Congress aren't going to be able to keep it classified.
No.
But the Patriot Act went too far. I was one of the people that voted against its reauthorization, and the USA Freedom Act, which was introduced by a Republican in the House and a Democrat in the Senate, would end the collection of metadata. Probably a wise step moving forward.
If you have questions about NSA surveillance at home or abroad for Senator Chris Murphy, you can join us 860-275-7266. Again, our number is 860-275-7266.
I wonder if there's not also an argument to be made. I have a bunch of questions about this, but an argument to be made for more coordination between what – I mean, the NSA seems like it's almost a rogue entity right now doing whatever it wants, and they have these incredible capacities that have never been seen before on the face of the earth, and they seem to be doing whatever they want to do. And a lot of it is counterproductive in all the ways that you just encountered over in Europe, and that's going to happen again and again. And some of it, you know, you mentioned the Ban Ki-moon incident where they intercepted his talking points going into a meeting with President Obama, and were quite proud of themselves for having done that. I think it might have been in the same article about that. I read in 2007 at a climate change conference, they were very proud of themselves for having gotten the cell phone number of the police chief of Bali, which is where they probably could have asked the police chief of Bali. I mean, some diplomat could have said, hey, it would be helpful if we had your cell phone number. And you know, these acts of invasion are so counterproductive to the kind of diplomacy that you're trying to engage in and that our State Department tries to engage in. There at least ought to be some kind of coordination here so that we're not constantly angering people, so that we don't have the president of Brazil refusing to have dinner with our president because they're so angry at us.
Yeah, and my sense is that, you know, at the NSA, you got rewarded, a big pat on the back, right? Mm-hmm. If you were able to get that cell phone or you were able to tap another world leader's phone, and there really wasn't that cost-benefit analysis happening on every new additional piece of information or avenue to get information that you could glean. And the president is undergoing this review right now that he's going to release at the end of the year. And I imagine part of that review is going to be a new process by which these agencies decide when to use their capabilities and when not to use their capabilities. So far, I frankly just don't think they've been drawing that line. And now we're seeing what the cost is to the United States.
What do you know about – we talked about the cost benefit. What do we know about the benefit? How much hard data are you provided with that says, here's how this sort of surveillance has kept us from having another 9/11 style attack or other attacks around the world? I mean, is it really helping, is I guess my question.
Yes, so there is a benefit, right? So we have – been able to intercept communications through these capabilities that have prevented about 50 planned attacks. Now, who knows how many of those were actually going to get to the ultimate stage of fruition, and who knows how many could have been foiled with other more traditional means of law enforcement investigation. But 50 attacks overall, 25 of them based in Europe. And so the Europeans need to know that this has accrued to their benefit as well. But of course, if you had total complete surveillance, if you listen in on every single phone conversation, every single private exchange that happens in this country, you would have total security. And that's just not a country we want to live in, right? We want to draw a line somewhere in which we are allowed to have private lives. And I think most people that I talk to in Connecticut acknowledge that we're on the wrong side of the line right now.
I just want to get to a quick phone call here. Sean is calling from Hartford. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just want to say that I think your point is valid regarding the sweeping authority of the NSA. We definitely need to curb that a bit. However, to your other point of where there were 50 attacks prevented in your example, I think the reality of the threats that the U.S. faces, both foreign and domestically, are very real, and that we need to have a much more targeted and, as you said, drilled down approach to isolating those folks and really taking executive authority to deal with those things in a comprehensive way that doesn't, you know, dissolve national security.
But let's acknowledge the circle here, right? We can have a strategy by which we surveil the world and try to chase terrorists from one ungovernable part of the globe to another. Or we can step back and ask why people want to do so much harm to the United States. What is it about the way in which we engage with our own citizens and the world that creates bulletin board material for extremist groups? The problem here is that we essentially feed the notion that the United States talks a good game on human rights and civil liberties, but then actually doesn't back it up with action when we are engaging in this kind of surveillance. So yes, we chase and find a lot of bad guys, but we frankly encourage folks to organize against us when we don't actually live out our ideals in the way that we interact with the rest of the world. And so I just think the most important conversation we need to have is what can we do to actually reduce the incentives for people to do harm to the United States. And we certainly aren't winning that argument with the way that we're doing surveillance today.
And also quickly, Colin, to the counterproductivity argument you were making before, it's not just silly that they're going after little pieces of information like the phone number of the police chief of Bali. It's that prior to 9/11, one of the things we found is when we gather a bunch of dots on a chart that we cannot connect in any way, shape, or form. When we have lots of information but no way of connecting these dots, it can be, in a way, counterproductive. Sure, we may have foiled some attempts potentially at harming the United States or United States interests, but indeed, the more data you collect, the more you need to actually pull those things together into a story.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm no intelligence expert, but it strikes me that you can at least divide what we're talking about into three categories. The first category is surveillance that is already targeting known operatives, people who do constitute a threat, people who have close relationships with other people who constitute a threat. In other words, there are people that we have very good reason to want to know about and know about what they're thinking and what they're doing. On the other end are people like Angela Merkel and the Secretary General of the UN, who do not, I don't think, pose any imminent threat to the United States, and probably we shouldn't be putting high-tech bugs in the Indian embassy and things like that. These are our allies. These are theoretically our friends. We probably shouldn't be spying on them. And then the third category is the vast middle ground of raw intelligence. How much raw intelligence do you need to find out the things that you don't know that you don't know? As Donald Rumsfeld would say, your unknown unknowns. And that's what the NSA is really good at these days, is looking through a lot of stuff. But I think, Senator Murphy, what you're sort of saying is, yeah, what's the tipping point there? How much stuff do you need to go through? How much do you need to know about the average citizen whom you have no probable cause to suspect in order to satisfy yourself?
Yeah, and again, we now know that there is potential for abuse here. Snowden went and took a lot of information about our capabilities, but there's nothing to say that someone eventually couldn't go and essentially decide to grab a whole bunch of content about our emails and about our phone conversations and put that online as well. So with the potential for abuse, that, I think, argues for some stricter limitations as well.
But before we move on to our break and we move off of some foreign policy stuff, I just want to ask you quickly, you know, reading in the Wall Street Journal as we follow this along today, the political crisis in Ukraine stalemated on Tuesday as opposition failed to pass a vote of no confidence in parliament. The government sought to calm days of street protest by apologizing for last weekend's violent police crackdown. This story in the Wall Street Journal, it actually quotes you, Senator Murphy, in your role as chairman of the European Affairs Subcommittee on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The idea is that some Ukrainians want to move toward Europe, and the government of Ukraine, near as I can tell, wants to stay near Russia. What you said to them is, being in Russia's backyard, the future of Ukraine will matter more to Russians than Americans. Clearly, the Russians have more at stake here. They're quoting you essentially to say that some American politicians are okay with the idea of America backing off of this entire Ukrainian crisis. Tell us a bit more about your take on what's happening in Ukraine and where the United States should position itself.
Well, this was all over a potential association agreement between Ukraine and the European Union. Ukraine was going to start moving towards joining the European Union. They eventually balked and decided to move towards Russia, and there are consequences for that. The Ukrainian people actually support joining the European Union, so there have been a million people out in the streets protesting President Yanukovych's decision. My only point here is that for Russia, it's just a fact of life that it matters more, given the fact that Ukraine is their neighbor, than it matters to the United States. That's why Yanukovych was over meeting with Putin for hours on end. That's why Russia apparently offered them $20 billion reportedly in money, either directly to Yanukovych and his allies or to the nation. I think the United States needs to play an active role in, and has played an active role in, trying to promote Ukraine in joining the West. I think acknowledging what is reality, in that anytime you're talking about a neighbor of Russia, it's going to matter more to them than it matters to the United States.
Yeah, but just very quickly, what is that, when you say an active role, what would a United States active role in bringing Ukraine closer to the West, or frankly, any country that wants to get closer to the West, what's the American active role that you're talking about?
So I'll give two examples. There are two carrots that we can offer the Ukrainians in deciding to join with Europe. One is an IMF loan that will help bail out their economy and set a platform for growth moving forward. That's going to be harder to achieve if they join the customs union. We can make that clear. And second is work to make that country energy independent. Part of the reason that they have to continue to do deals with Russia is because they rely on Russian gas to essentially keep the country warm in the winter. They have vast shale reserves in that country. They need Americans' help from a technological standpoint to access it. That's something that we can offer.
Senator Chris Murphy joins us in the wheelhouse today. It's our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe, as always, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show, is with me as well. And we're going to take your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. People want to ask about Obamacare and the rollout, how it's been going in Connecticut and elsewhere. People want to ask about Metro North and our commuter system, whether or not the federal government can do something about what seems like a broken system that gets people in and out of New York. 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so we're in the wheelhouse. It's our weekly news roundtable. A little different format today. We have a special guest, Colin McEnroe, is with me, but also Senator Chris Murphy joins us in studio. The cameras of CTN are here as well. And you can join us with your questions for Senator Murphy, 860-275-7266. Again, it's 860-275-7266, or email wherelive at WNPR.org. Let's go to John in Kensington. Hey there, John. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. You know, I was just thinking, I'm not opposed to spying on our enemies. I don't know how I feel about spying on our friends. As Colin said last week about the Newtown 911 tape, you don't know if you need to hear it until you hear it. So I'm okay with that. But what my concern is, if the federal government couldn't secure what we found out, and a very low-level person walked off with, you know, the black box, how about the Obama website with everybody's health information and all their personal IDs? What's going to keep someone from Indonesia to go and crack that website and steal everyone in America's ID.
Oh, so you're worried about people hacking into the Obamacare website, the Affordable Care Act website. This is an interesting transition, of course, from the NSA to Obamacare. So, well, what do you say to John and Kensington, first of all, Senator?
Well, we've invested a lot of time and money and effort at the federal level and at the state level in making sure that those are secure sites. But we know that there have been attempts to hack into the state exchange's website and at the federal level as well. I mean, I think we should back up here for a second and have a little bit of context in the sense that Google knows a lot more about me than the NSA does, and that's probably the case for most citizens of this state. And we aren't having enough of a conversation about commercial data privacy. And,
but I opted into Google. I signed up for that Gmail account.
No, that's absolutely true. But frankly, we have a different standard in the United States than they do in Europe. They have to opt in to a lot more than we do here, essentially by clicking into that web page, you have decided to give away your information. Not everybody understands that when they choose to join Facebook or Google, they are essentially giving all of their search data to those companies. I think it's a valid concern that anytime you're going online, you have to be worried about the potential for somebody to hack into that site and get your information. I'm confident that with respect to the state exchange and the federal exchange, notwithstanding the complications they've had on people getting access to healthcare.gov, that we've got as secure a site as you can possibly build.
As secure a site as we possibly can build, probably not as efficient a site as we can possibly build.
No.
We heard you on MSNBC getting into it with a very feisty television host who was going back and forth with you because you were essentially saying that, you know, the media is making an awful lot of this. It's not making it easier for this rollout. And clearly, as we've heard locally here, Kevin Counihan, who runs the state exchange, says, you know, give it time. It's just started. You know, this is going to ramp up over time. But look, frankly, people have been disappointed, and that's a fair way to say it, in the rollout of this Obamacare website. At this point, how do you think this is going? Do you think that we're going to be able to get things back on track in a way that will build enough confidence in the system moving forward, notwithstanding whether or not it's going to technically work, but actually build confidence in the entire idea of the Affordable Care Act?
I do think it's going to work, and I think Connecticut is example number one. Why? Because we have technology that allows you to get to the product, and what we've seen is that people really like the product. We have had signups and enrollments both in the private health exchange and in the Medicaid expansion that far outpace our initial estimates here in Connecticut. And frankly, states that are running good exchanges with functioning websites have seen the same thing, whether it be Tennessee or New York or California. And so the underlying question here is, will the product sell once people can get to it? Once they can get into the store, are they going to take it off the shelf? And Connecticut is an example of why you can answer that question affirmatively. There is no excuse for the problems that have been going on with the federal website. But the point that I was making on MSNBC is that we are spending 10 times more effort in the media talking about the problems than we are talking about the transformational, life-changing benefits that people are getting when they get insurance for the first time. And I just want to make sure that somebody is telling that side of the story as well. And listen, I think it's getting out there, but I think right now the focus is all on the problems and not enough about how it's changing lives.
Although, you know, I think there are sort of two conversations to have here. One of them is, does the website work? And the other one is, do the numbers work? And you probably saw Ellen Andrews' op-ed piece in the Hartford Current on Sunday. She's saying basically in some ways the Connecticut numbers don't work that well, that really a lot of these products are more expensive than what people had previously had access to, and that for some of the sectors. And one of the dangers, I think, with having these highly tailored and customized plans that vary quite a bit from state to state, I mean, there may be standardization of benefits, but, you know, this kind of shopping process for plans means that, you know, we're all finding out at the same time how well the numbers work. And maybe it's a question of giving it time, but there's a lot of variation from state to state in terms of how expensive stuff is or how big a bite of your income these things take. And I don't know. I feel still kind of agnostic about whether the numbers work or not.
I think what Connecticut is also seeing is that we've had pretty robust signups amongst the young well, which is, of course, what you need in order to make these pools work. And that's the big question, is that this does not work if 18 to 35-year-olds who are relatively healthy don't sign up. And in Connecticut, we're relatively confident that we're going to get a big enough pool to make the thing work in the end. And you're also going to, I think, you're going to see prices come down over time, right? When insurers put their initial prices onto the exchange, they're going to be betting on the worst case, right? They're going to put numbers and premium prices that assume that you're not going to get the young people in. And as you build the pool, a lot of those price structures will be reduced. I don't think they're going up. I think they're coming down over time. So, yeah, I think you've got to give this time to play out. But the fact is that people thought they had cheap insurance because they were paying very little up front. And what they were finding out is that when they actually got sick, they didn't have much coverage. And so for a lot of folks that are upset, legitimately upset about their policies being canceled, they do need to look into what those policies actually were. And what you are going to get on the exchange is real insurance, which will cover you when you get sick and save us a lot of money, taxpayers and private premium payers, because we won't have to subsidize through some other mechanism your care that you are going to have to pay for once you found that big hole in your coverage.
Were you privy to any conversations that came out of the White House when it blew up essentially in the administration's face that they were going to have to go back and essentially go with their original word, which is if you had health insurance before, you could keep that health insurance, even if it was fairly lousy health insurance. Essentially, President Obama said, we need to allow for you to do that. Were you privy to any sort of discussions about how the White House was going to handle that or anything that happened in the aftermath? It's just it was a very interesting move that, of course, threw up a lot of problems in the faces of the states trying to figure out, are we going to offer up these health plans that the president has said will now be available? I mean, that did turn into a bit of a mess.
Yeah, but let's be clear about what the law said, right? The law said that if the plan didn't change to the detriment of the beneficiary, then that plan could continue to be offered. They could actually make changes. They could make changes that added benefits, or they could make changes that simply passed along the general rate of healthcare inflation to the customer. They could make other changes, like within the drug formulary. As long as you made minimal changes or your changes actually helped the beneficiary, you didn't have to cancel the plan. And so I frankly think that the president and his folks have done a little bit too much apologizing over this, because the reality is that a lot of these plans didn't have to be canceled. A lot of the insurance companies just decided to do it because they wanted to get out of that business, given the fact that they were offering plans on the exchange. So listen, I think that there are a lot of people who believed, because of some of the things that the president said, that they were going to be able to keep their health care no matter what. And he probably should have been better about explaining what the law actually said. But these insurers could have continued to offer the plans had they made minimal changes rather than essentially planned on wholesale changes.
I just want to get to a quick phone call here. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Jeff's in Madison. Hello, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator.
Morning.
I just wanted to check in with you and see if I could offer a bit of a reality check. The reason why there is such an uproar about this law is because of the reality of it. We've watched the experts testify in Congress that this site is not secure. It's far from secure. Okay? Second of all, the site isn't even, the system isn't even completely built yet. There is no mechanism with which to pay out to the insurance companies, and now I'm hearing that they're going to be able to give an estimate, which we can true up later on down the road. This is broken. This system is broken, and it's only 2 months into its inception. We cannot wax poetic and say, well, I believe this and I believe that. What's going on is the American citizen is witnessing reality, and the truth has a certain ring to it. And guess what, Mr. Murphy? You're not telling it.
Yeah, and listen, what I'm saying is that it's a temporary reality, and I'm not underplaying this, right? This is bad, right? I mean, this website should have been up and running on day one, given the fact that the country was split on whether they supported the law or not. The fact that the website wasn't ready to go on day one was just another reason for people's confidence in the law to be undermined. There is no excuse for the fact that the technology wasn't ready. I am not understating the either political or real-world impact of people not being able to access the website from day one. What I'm saying is that in the long run, and I think as a senator or congressman, you have the obligation and responsibility to play the long game. The product is going to work and sell. And so once the technology gets online, I believe that the law is by and large going to work as intended. But I'm not trying to underplay what has been a real bad deal for a lot of people in the first couple of months of the law's implementation.
You know, I think one of the points he was trying to make is that the question of the so-called back end of the system. In other words, once the Obama administration realized that it had massive problems with the website, it decided to throw most of its resources,
right,
of its tech surge at the thing that was the most visible problem, the interface between the average person and the system itself, the person trying to sign up. Got to make it easier for the website to work, for people to sign up. But one thing that they're acknowledging is in order to do that, they're delaying work on the so-called back end, which is the mechanism which actually connects the person who has signed up to the actual insurers, connects the insurers to their reimbursements, all that kind of stuff. And obviously, that guy was pretty angry. But, I mean, an average person might be kind of frightened. People get scared about health insurance. If they get all done signing up and they think, well, do I really have health insurance? Does this really work well enough? I mean, does the so-called back end work well enough so that I'm not going to find out 3 or 4 months from now when something catastrophic is going on that my health insurance isn't really in place the way I think it is? I mean, this isn't just sort of an angry citizenry that guy might have been, but these are people you get really scared, I think, if you don't know whether your health insurance works.
No, this is real-world stuff, and the administration is focusing a lot of time on making sure that people can get into the product, but that doesn't mean they haven't worked on the back end as well. I guess my overall point is that if the problem is technology, the problem can be fixed. If the problem is the underlying number or the fact that the product just doesn't work for people, then that's a bigger long-term product problem. I think we can solve the technology problem, and I don't think we have an underlying flaw in the design of the law. But you're right. I mean, when January 1st comes, you know, we hope that we don't have a second problem on our hands, which is where people who signed up for a product actually don't have it delivered to their doorstep. And I know the administration's working on that.
Oh, we're talking with Senator Chris Murphy today. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe, as always, joins me here. And we're taking your phone calls as well, 860-275-7266. Talking a bit about health care right now with the senator. Marcy is calling from Manchester. Hello, Marcy. You're on
Hi.
Where We Live.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for Senator Murphy. He wrote a pretty thoughtful piece in the Hartford Courant about these for-profit hospital conversions. Speaking of healthcare, we in the Manchester area are going to be voting on Tenet Healthcare's acquisition of Manchester Memorial Hospital and Rockville Hospital. And, you know, I just feel that with these for-profit hospital conversions, we don't really have the broad information that we need. I mean, ECHN has done a pretty good job of expressing, you know, why they think this is the right move at the right time and what their process has been. But, you know, in terms of what these for-profit hospital conversions are doing in terms of dominating a market and raising prices, Tenet has kind of a Tenet is very leveraged. I don't know what that means in terms of our own future community health care system. I would really love for Senator Murphy to kind of initiate some kind of a statewide forum or conversation where we get a broader range of perspectives and some expert opinions from people who've really had experience with this or are doing research on it.
Marcy, first of all, thank you very much for that. I'll have Senator Murphy maybe explain a bit about what he wrote back in August and try to address your question. But thank you very much for raising that.
I think this is one of the most important questions that Connecticut is going to face in the next 12 months. We have an application for an out-of-state for-profit hospital company, Tenet Healthcare, to take over a handful of hospitals in Connecticut. My fear is that that will essentially create a cascading effect by which you then will have a number of other nonprofit hospitals in the state go seek for-profit partners, and in a short amount of time, the majority of institutional acute care healthcare in this state will be run by for-profit companies. Here's what we know about for-profit healthcare. In states that have a majority of their hospitals in for-profit status, healthcare costs more. Those for-profit hospitals tend to look for the more profitable services and shed the less profitable services. What are the less profitable services? outpatient psychiatric, for instance, something that we desperately need more of in Connecticut. Tenet has paid a huge premium to buy this company Vanguard that made the initial application to buy Bristol and Waterbury Hospital. In order to repay their investors for the premium that they paid, they have to glean enormous savings from those hospitals beyond what you get just by the power of bulk purchasing. They are going to have to cut services. They are going to have to lay off staff. Ultimately, I think Connecticut would be better off if our hospitals remained run on a not-for-profit basis. The problem, though, is that hospitals have very few places to go if they want capital dollars to expand, renovate, improve their campuses. And so the solution is going to have to lie somewhere in Hartford, by which we're going to have to find a new mechanism to give these hospitals access to capital improvement dollars other than the for-profits. And so I have been, and I'm going to continue to be pretty outspoken in my skepticism about the utility of for-profits coming in and running hospitals. But there is going to have to be some response from Hartford to give another avenue for improvement to these hospitals.
Short of even finding new capital for them to improve, these hospitals have been complaining this year that their funding from the state has been cut, indeed, that maybe that's even forcing them closer toward the precipice of wanting to try to engage a for-profit company.
Yeah, but listen, these for-profit companies, they're not coming in with some big gift, right? I mean, this is not money that shows up at your door that doesn't have strings attached. If they're putting money into the hospital, then they need that money back, and they need that money back with a pretty significant premium on top of it. So I just don't want people to think that these for-profit companies are coming in here with some amount of charitable largesse. They're not. Every dollar they come back in, they put in, they're going to take out, and they're going to take out with money on top of it to repay their investors. I think there are some nonprofit operators that are pretty decent. The folks that took over Sharon Hospital have been warmly received by the community in Northwest Connecticut. But by and large, I don't think this is the way that we should go. George Jepson wrote an op-ed in The Current this weekend, which asked for additional powers in his office to review these applications. I really hope that the legislature takes that proposal seriously next year.
Did you have a thought, Colin?
The one question that I guess I have about this kind of circles back to the what we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, which is how this new system is going to work. You know, the way that I understand it in my own primitive way is that, you know, once again, it uses kind of market forces and individual behavior in order to create certain kinds of results, and it uses the market ultimately, and maybe an expansion of the market and the way healthcare services are accessed to control costs. I think in some ways, to a lot of people, it makes less and less of a difference whether it's a for-profit or a not-for-profit hospital. They see hospital costs as wildly out of control. Yesterday's New York Times, big, huge story about, you know, these people who go in and they get three stitches and they get a bill for $1,000. And I'm wondering, too, if one of the other things, one of the other secondary or tertiary conversations that Congress will be having about Obamacare is whether it needs to actively control costs even beyond the amount of control that exists right now.
So, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to talk about a healthcare marketplace, right? I mean, this marketplace doesn't operate like any other marketplace in the world. There's very little consumer choice when it comes to the most expensive interventions, because when you're the sickest, you have the least ability to shop around. You're picking the product, but somebody else is paying for it. So it doesn't really work to essentially rely on traditional consumer dynamics to have to force price sensitivity. So I do argue that the government has to play a firmer role here. For instance, on the way that we buy prescription drugs, it simply has not worked to ask seniors to go out and be the people who enforce price competition. The federal government should be purchasing drugs in bulk for the Medicare program, negotiating a lower price based on the huge discount you can get when you're negotiating on behalf of all Medicare beneficiaries. And that would get lower prices equaling about $50 billion in savings over 10 years beyond what we're doing now, which is divvying up purchasing power amongst dozens of small health insurers who offer Medicare Part D plans today. So the federal government has to play a firmer role in keeping prices down, because the healthcare marketplace just doesn't work today to do that job.
I want to get to a quick call from Doug in Bethlehem before we take a break. Go ahead, Doug.
Hi, I just wanted to counterbalance the angry guy. My wife and I should be reaping the significant benefits from the new law if the numbers prove to be right come January. Right now we have a $10,000 deductible, and that's going down to $500 for each of us, and we're saving $400 a month in premiums once the new plan kicks in.
Hey, Doug, how was the sign-up process for you? Did it all make sense?
Well, we contacted our health insurance provider, and he was one of the ones that the state trained to walk us through this, and it was a great experience through him.
Doug, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And obviously, this is an ongoing conversation we'll have here on Where We Live It on WNPR in the months ahead. We're talking with Senator Chris Murphy, along with Colin McEnroe. We're in the wheelhouse. It's our Wednesday News Roundtable. We're going around the world of news with Senator Murphy. We're going to take some more of your calls at 860-275-7266. We want to talk a bit about Metro North, talk about the Newtown anniversary coming up, talk about the nuclear option in the Senate. There's still a lot to cover in the last few minutes of the wheelhouse. You can join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, but a special guest today, Senator Chris Murphy, joins us in studio. So we're taking some of your phone calls about a wide range of issues, 860-275-7266. As always, I'm joined by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. What's on the show this afternoon, Colin?
Well, it'll be kind of a nice segue from some of the things we're talking about right now. Our show today is about blood pressure. It's also about the new American Heart Association guidelines, which have become somewhat controversial, particularly based on the kinds of studies that led to them. But we're really going to concentrate also on the notion of blood pressure, what it actually is, and whether or not it's treated the right way in America. There actually is a particular Dr. Samuel Mann, who says that most Americans who have any kind of hypertension are either on the wrong medication, they're over-medicated, or under-medicated, that it's actually a kind of a poorly understood phenomenon, which is amazing considering the number of times over the course of your life you will have your blood pressure checked.
I'm wondering if I should have a blood pressure checked later today.
I could bring in a monitor.
Maybe we should do that a little bit later on. That's at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Thomas is calling from Storrs. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a political science student here at UConn, and I just wanted to call this morning to ask Senator Murphy about the underfunding of infrastructure in this country, especially in light of the recent increase in failures of our roads, bridges, and railroads. We saw over the summer the New Haven Line, which is owned by the state of Connecticut, have multiple serious failures, which is in need of huge improvements to its tracks and bridges and the rest of the system. When it was shut down in October because of the electric failure, it cost the state approximately $62 billion in economic activity. We also have on our roads and bridges the Aetna Viaduct in Hartford coming to the end of its design life, as well as the I-84 Route 8 interchange in Waterbury. And every one of these projects alone is going to cost tens of billions of dollars that would normally come from the federal government. Just to maintain the state's transportation system as it currently is, to say nothing of, you know, future-oriented investments like high-speed rail for the Northeast or modernizing our city's transportation systems. Now, I just wanted to call to ask the senator, Congressman Blumenauer is going to introduce a bill in the House today to raise the federal gas tax, which hasn't been raised in 20 years now, and would help to pull the Highway Trust Fund out, which is nearly at bankruptcy. And I just, Senator Murphy, if you think that that's raising a good idea to raise the gas tax by a few cents to fund a lot of our, you know, critical transportation needs, or if not, how do you think it would be best to, you know, fund a lot of these really important projects that, if they don't go through, will really have disastrous effects for the state?
Thomas, thank you very much.
Well, you know, we're living with the woeful state of infrastructure in Connecticut right now. We certainly don't know yet what caused the deadly crash over the weekend. It may have been an Atkins driver error, but we certainly know that the derailment in Fairfield was due to rails that were not working underneath the trains. And what we also know is that we have about $50 billion of work from Boston to Washington that has to be done over the next 10 years just to maintain the state of good repair. And until we find a better way to finance transportation transportation improvements than the gas tax, then you have to support an increase in the gas tax if you want to be intellectually honest about supporting increased investment in infrastructure. That has been traditionally the way in which we have funded these improvements. And as the caller said, we haven't raised it in decades now. We're going to need to if we want to put the money in. We spend 3% of our GDP on infrastructure in the United States. Europe spends about 6%. China today spends about 10%. This is a job creator in the short run. And for Connecticut, there's virtually nothing else that matters more to our economic salvation than improving the viaducts to New York and to Boston. But, you know, politicians don't want to be for tax increases. And here's the consequence of that is that we are running out of money to run our government. We collect 17% of federal GDP in taxes today. That is simply not enough to do what we need to do to fund retirement programs, to take care of our social service needs, and to build the country. We're going to have to raise taxes somewhere, somehow, if you want to avoid these disasters and improve our economy moving forward.
I'll just say quickly, the next Tuesday on our program, the DOT commissioner will be here. We'll be talking about some of these same issues. Next Thursday on the show, we'll be replaying a conversation I had last night with the DEEP commissioner, Dan Esty. One of the things we talked about goes to this tweet from Ben here. Since climate change is the biggest issue we face, what is Senator Murphy doing to remove subsidies to fossil fuels?
Well, there's no excuse for why we continue to subsidize fossil fuel production, given the record profits year after year that companies like ExxonMobil continue to make. And they pale in comparison to the subsidies that we provide renewable sources. You know, I was in Germany last week. Germany is leading the world in terms of the production of things like solar panels and wind turbines, despite the fact that there's not a lot of sun and not a lot of wind in Germany compared to the United States. Why are they doing that? Because they have a feed-in tariff system, a subsidy system that promotes the purchase of wind turbines and solar panels in Germany. Until the United States creates a domestic market for those products, they're going to be made in places like Germany and China. So from a global warming standpoint, we should be ending subsidies for fossil fuel producers and increasing subsidies for renewable energy, but also from a jobs perspective, there are millions of jobs to be created in that field. They're just not going to be created in the United States if we don't have a really vibrant, robust domestic marketplace for renewable energy.
We have just a few minutes left, and there's just a few topics we still want to get to very, very quickly. Is there significance beyond a lot of fodder for nighttime talk and comedy shows of the Senate vote on the nuclear option, the idea that we would need just a simple majority to get the president's appointees to the judicial branch or some to the executive branch, that we'd be able to get them through on a clear 51-49 vote? Is there a big significance there? Is there something that we think is going to come out of this that may be politically bad for Democrats down the road?
I don't know what the politics are down the road, but there's major significance in the short run in that you actually get people on the courts that are supported by the president that the people elected and the Senate that the people elected. And I would hope that in the end this spells doom for the filibuster with respect to legislation on the floor of the Senate. I think our founding fathers are rolling over in their graves seeing the supermajority that is now required to pass a simple amendment to a bill in the United States Senate. There's got to be accountability at some point in government. And there is none today because when the Senate doesn't do something, the American public assumes that it's because the majority can't get their act together, like on gun control, when the reality is that the minority controls the day-to-day business in the Senate because of the requirement that you get 60 votes on everything. And so just to restore some basic means of accountability in government, you've got to get rid of the filibuster. I don't really care if Republicans ultimately take control of the White House and the House and the Senate because if they do, that's what the people wanted. And the people should get the policy direction that they ask for and not have the minority in the Senate be able to set the agenda.
Well, you probably do care, actually. But just on the subject of accountability, I mean, another aspect of this is, I mean, just imagine a scenario in which President Obama decided that Secretary Sebelius was accountable and should be fired. Under the old system, he would be reluctant to get rid of her because he might not be able to appoint a replacement. I mean, you know, if you want accountability, you've got to at least give the president some kind of room to replace people and actually have replacements come in.
Yeah, and also, you know, when we think about who we appoint to the bench here in Connecticut, we've got to think about people who are so, you know, we got to think about people that can gain 60 votes. And that is a different type of person sometimes that can gain 50 votes. Sometimes you shy away from folks who have any type of controversy in their past because of the necessity to reach that 60 vote threshold. And so it also will change the composition of people that are chosen and maybe allow some people who have done some more interesting and perhaps controversial things to get on the agenda for federal appointments.
There's much more that we could talk about, but we have run out of time today in the Wheelhouse. And so I want to thank our guest, Senator Chris Murphy, for coming by. Very good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Colin McEnroe, as always, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show, who joins us each Wednesday here in the Wheelhouse. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, sir.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives. Katie Talarski is the senior producer of Where We Live. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Check out our brand new website, and you can follow along this conversation and others. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.